Welcome to Bounce Back Stronger, the podcast that explores ways to find peace and purpose no matter what happens. I'm your host, Donna Ferris, and today we're honored to welcome Dr. Stephen S. Tang, an esteemed expert in crisis leadership. With a distinguished career spanning over three decades, Stephen has garnered multiple awards for his exemplary leadership in fostering innovation and entrepreneurship worldwide. Stephen's tenure as chairman or CEO of public corporations in life sciences and energy technology, coupled with his impactful roles in nonprofits and government advisory boards, underscores his commitment to driving positive change. From 2018 to 2022, he adeptly guided OraSure Technologies, Inc. through the challenges of the COVID-19 crisis and the creation of the IntelliSwab COVID-19 test. He did this with compassion and resilience. I can't wait to hear Stephen's thoughts on crisis leadership and the invaluable lessons he gained around work-life balance during his extensive experience in the biotech industry. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen. I look forward to learning from you today.
Pleasure to be here, Donna.
Well, let's just jump right in. Can you share a little bit about your journey as CEO of OraSure Technologies and how it shaped your perspective on crisis leadership?
I've been very fortunate. I've had a non-linear career with several interesting stops, crossing industries, crossing roles, crossing for-profit, nonprofit, academic settings. Really very blessed. I would characterize my OraSure journey as quite unexpected. I knew the company when I was a graduate school at Lehigh University. I knew the founders, but they were always an interesting company with interesting science behind it. Never dreamed that I'd be working for them, and never dreaming that I would be a board member, a chairman, and CEO. Specifically, it began for me in 2003, 2004, when the original founder of the company, a guy named Mike Gosling, was stepping down as CEO, and he said, "Hey, Steve, you should throw your hat in the ring for this." So I did, and quite unexpectedly, I was competing with a former management consulting client of mine for the job.
Wow.
He got the job. I did not get the job. So there is resiliency and redemption in this story as well. Later on, he called me a few years into his tenure and said, "Would you like to be on the board of directors?" As I tell amusingly, I became a board member and chairman of the compensation committee, which determines the CEO's compensation. And then when he was stepping down as chairman, I became head of the CEO search committee until the board asked me to consider throwing my hat into the ring for that job as well. And so that's a very long way of saying I eventually got the job that I wanted over the course of about 20 years.
That's impressive, really. I had a conversation recently with actually my husband, which we both know. And he reminded me that can't just take no, you have to keep going at it. And that's pretty impressive that you were able to keep going back and being willing to go back. How do you do that?
Well, I have to credit my parents for that, particularly my mother. Both my parents are Chinese immigrants. My mother came over from China in the proverbial slow boat, landing in San Francisco back in the 1940s. And her father, so my grandfather, was a diplomat, and he taught the family to read on that slow boat with two books, the Bible and How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
Oh, I love that book.
And I think this is very much steeped into how we view our lives and what it's like to be an American, which is you need to get along with people. And these days, I think more than ever, right? And ultimately, in my case, what it came down to was learning that you have to look past your own personal disappointment in situations, learn something for them. In my case with OraSure's board, I kept in touch with the board, even though they picked somebody else over the years. And the fundamental lesson, I think, is never burn bridges. Life, as I say, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Yes.
And every verse you may encounter similar people, the same people, and it's good to be in front of them with positive intent and sort of manage your own sense of disappointment sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, the Buddhists would say any learning is a good learning. Criticism is a good thing. It Maybe not everything somebody says or all the feedback may not be correct, but there's probably something in there that we can learn from. But it's hard, though. The ego is a really strong thing and it can be really difficult. I really admire anyone that can step over those times of disappointment and find ways to move forward and then to go back is really impressive.
Well, it's happened a couple of times for me in my life, as I outline in the book. And I'm not discounting the fact that it's hard to lose. It hurts when you lose. It hurts when you fail. Nevertheless, life will bring you circumstances and people over and over again. And when it's time, then the time is right, things happen. So there's a lesson in patience there also.
I like this idea that is out there. I think there's even a book called Fail Better, I think, or Fail Up. The idea that we are going to fail. We both have worked in technology. And one of the things I like about the development cycle is it expects failure, right? It expects bugs, expects things not to work out. At the end of that cycle of development, you go back and look at it and you all talk about all the things that went wrong and the things that went right, and then you try to improve. I love that. I think that there's not enough of that maybe in business in general, where we say, here's our strategic plan, here's what we're going to do this year, here's what worked, here's what didn't, how should we change? I think there's a lot about failure that we could learn from and do better.
There's a tension, as you know, in business between predictability. So, particularly in Wall Street terms, Wall Street craves predictability. But in reality, innovation is not predictable at all. And sometimes the closer you think you are to complete collapse and failure, success is right around the corner. And sometimes when there's an inkling that success is around the corner, it's a total burnout. So, how we come to grips with that cognitive dissonance between the business world wanting predictability and innovation being unpredictable is one of the secrets, I think, to breakthroughs in our world and managing our own expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk a bit in your book about how everybody manages to the stockholder and they should be managing to the stakeholder. I'd love to give you a second to talk about that. This is one of my favorite ideas. I actually wrote about it when I was in school, and I love stakeholder management approaches. So I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, every good idea has its day, I guess. And so business schools throughout the 60s and 70s taught that the only thing that corporations were beholden to were their shareholders and making a profit. I think as the world has gotten more interconnected and as our challenges have become more complex and complicated, there's a larger group of stakeholders that need to be satisfied by the mission of a company. I think it's that simple. We've reached this point of complexity where the shareholder-only model of managing expectations is a bit obsolete. In the book, I go through some effort to talk about share owners versus share renters, which is a term I borrowed from Simon Sinek. It's tempting to spell Simon's name Cynic, but it's not. It's Sinek. Simon's view is that the way that the stock market works these days, it's easy for somebody to borrow shares on the market or become a temporary share owner, and they're essentially a share renter in that case, and make demands of a company. Those are called activist shareholders, and push an agenda that may not be in the interest of longer-term shareholders. The employees, the suppliers, the customers, in the case of healthcare, the patients. That's one of the vagaries of capitalism that we live in today. But I do think there's a version of conscious capitalism that makes much more sense for our time and our age and our challenges ahead. But that's the situation I was given that I had to cope with and ultimately manage through my own disappointment.
Yeah, exactly. I think that this might lead us nicely into the discussion of compassionate leadership. It doesn't lead to that, right? When you're focusing on the stockholder, it's harder to be a compassionate leader, or at least it doesn't, it's not something that the stockholder values.
Well, I think in very stark terms, if people are numbers and numbers need to be reduced, and that leads to a very cold-hearted, cold-blooded way of viewing numbers and people, that's what you get. I think we've been through an era, we've seen that in work and not work time and time again. I think the special circumstances of the pandemic made a much more compassionate style, not a nice to have, but a must have. if you were trying to do big, great things that had never been done before, which is what we tried to do at OraSure Technologies.
Talk about the weekly writing that you did for your employees during the pandemic while they were really actively making a huge difference to all of us by creating this test. And remind me the name of the book again, because everyone should read it. It's really, really amazing.
The book is called A Test for Our Time, Crisis Leadership in the Next Normal. In case you're wondering, the book's title, A Test for Our Time, probably has four meanings. One is what you describe, which is the story behind the invention and development and manufacture of IntelliSwab, which Oprah Winfrey calls the easiest test to use of its kind. It must be right. She's Oprah, right? The other meaning of the book, A Test for Our Time, is my personal leadership test during the pandemic, the moment of truth for myself. A third meaning is a test for our time was OraSure as a company transforming itself in a time of crisis. And perhaps the fourth meaning, which is one which I hope is enduring beyond what we've already lived through, is in this next normal, which I think is everything everywhere all at once in terms of crisis and the ripple effects. How do we lead through that, knowing that there are bound to be multiple crises that we have to attend to at any given time? And so it really projects what I hope are the learnings, much of it rooted in compassionate leadership, into the future with the hope that we learn something for that and can bounce back better beyond the pandemic.
It's an idea that crises is not an abnormal thing. It is going to be a normal thing. And the idea that maybe we have to get used to that idea and figure out ways that we're going to cope regardless of what happens.
Precisely. I was tempted to label the future the next abnormal or the new abnormal. That sounded a bit defeatist. And so that's why I prefer the term next normal, which is beyond and what's next. But you're right. It is fundamentally a mentality that says something could go wrong today and I'm going to have to handle it. And so and when you put the expectation out there like that, you tend to create portfolios of solutions, not just be anchored or attached to one approach. And you're going to have to be adjusting constantly through it, and you'll need people that can do the same. And I think that's what we lived through is none of us knew back in March 2020 what this was going to be about. You mentioned the letters I wrote to employees every week. We called those Monday motivational messages. They started out as just informational things. I needed to reassure folks that I was not going to bring them back to the office under adverse situations. So their safety came first. And over time, I think I tried to recognize that we were all in a bunker mentality. We were all hunkered down. Life seemed very strange. I openly acknowledged what I would say are the grief of not being able to celebrate holidays like Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, graduations, baby showers, weddings, funerals. During the first year and a half or so, those just didn't happen. And so giving people an outlet to think about those things and connect with a part of their lives that was meaningful to them, I think became one of my duties. The anthem that I express in the book, Lead Whole People Wholeheartedly, is really about that. It was recognizing that in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a CEO wasn't just responsible for self-actualization and motivation of the employees. It was basic fundamental needs like safety, well-being, and that stretched from physical well-being to mental and spiritual well-being as well. So there are a whole bunch of things that I think leaders need to take responsibility for that we learned in the pandemic that I think projects well into the future if we can have that sort of mindset and approach to dealing with our people.
Well, everything is done through the people and companies always say that they are the most important asset. I'm not sure that it is, but it is definitely something we say.
Easy to say,
So
hard to do.
exactly, very hard to do, I think, with the other things that you talked about with the bottom line, aspects. And I don't think anybody in any management role relishes any of that happens, in terms of having to do bottom line types of decisions. But it'd be interesting to see if the focus changed more on the people and making sure that they are challenged and taken care of, and their mental and physical well-being was addressed, what would happen? I think there's a lot of things that people try to do, but it's hard. It's hard to do.
Well, I think the mindset has to be leaders own those issues on behalf of their employees. It's not optional anymore. I think we see right now on return to work mandates how we're struggling to deal with hybrid work as if it were something that we need to just dispense of rather than maximize and optimize for everybody's benefit. So we're struggling in that sort of in-between period. It's like we're growing out our hair and it just doesn't look very good right now, right?
That's a really good way of putting it. Remote work really does create challenges. I think the biggest one that I see is connection, is the lack of connection and being able to easily build a rapport with somebody and trust. I think the trust thing is really problematic. What are your thoughts maybe on that?
Well, fundamentally, that's the core of leading whole people wholeheartedly is trust. And, I have a formula for it in the book. Trust is equal to credibility times intimacy divided by risk. So what does that mean? Credibility is you're competent, you do your job, you say what you're going to do. Intimacy is quite different. Intimacy means I trust you because I know you have my back. And the reason that those are expressed as the product of each other is in order for trust to be very high, you need to both credibility and intimacy. Now, the risk factor in the case of Orshore, trying to do something we had never done before at a scale we'd never done it, meant that it was an extremely high-risk situation. So as a leader, I needed to convince my board and my people that this was something that was worth pursuing, number one, and number two, that we could do it. So think about how you need to build the well and bank of trust through credibility and intimacy to be able to soar above all the challenges under ideal circumstances with innovation, doing something you've never done before, but also under the pandemic where we couldn't physically be near each other. So many counterintuitive lessons. We hired a number of people, relocated them to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania from California and Florida. That wasn't supposed to be able to happen. We somehow got to trust each other as disembodied Zoom squares on a screen 24/7. We learned to cope with the stress of a working couple with kids being cyber schooled in the same house that wasn't equipped for all those screens and that kind of privacy. So it's just on and on and on. You think of the challenges that went on. We should learn something from that. And I think that to me, the lesson is you can have high trust if you intentionally build it. And you can create space for people to live their own lives, to know that you care about their own lives beyond work. And they will do extraordinary things for you because they believe in your cause and they trust you.
And you'll stand out. I think when you
Yes.
do that, it stands out, especially today in the lack of connection that we all face as the residue or the hangover from the pandemic. I think when you do take the extra effort to be kind and trustworthy and caring, it stands out.
Yes, I think too much of this today has been framed as a, is it the power in the workers' hands or is it power in the management leadership hands? And I think it's, if we reframed it as this is a competitive advantage for an employer to be a conscientious, caring, compassionate employer and foster that level of trust in, within their culture. That's the magic and that's the secret. Now, to do that, I think we're going to have to very intentionally address the skills and approach needed to be effective in a hybrid work setting. It just doesn't happen by accident. And somebody who may have been good at something as arcane as management by walking around, remember that one? Well, how do they operate when they can't walk around, when the people aren't around them? I think we can do it. I just don't think we've been very intentional about it to date.
And I think some of that is the building of the trust, right? So that the employee wants to interact with you, feels like it's a good thing for their career and for their mental state, which I think is not to be discounted. And it's not a transactional relationship.
For sure, for sure. One of the things that I hear often is, well, if people aren't in the same building or room together or office together, then their professional development is going to suffer, right? Because they can't be mentored, they can't be nurtured by more senior people. And I think that's true, but I also think it's true that the way we were doing it before the pandemic wasn't exactly great. I mean, I didn't hear anybody say, Oh my gosh, we're spending way too much time on professional development and mentoring, right? Said no one ever, right?
No one ever.
So there has to be some model that replaces our old way of thinking. I think some of it is just making time.
Yeah.
Don't have so many meetings. Rely on technology. Rely on what's called asynchronous communication, which is the information's out there. You read it when you can read it, respond to it when you can respond to it, and use in-person time and gathering time, synchronous time together in meetings and gatherings to form cohesiveness within the team, to build that trust, right? But that's a very different way of thinking about things.
Oh, it is. I couldn't agree with you more, though. I do think, too, the benefit of having the Zoom world, especially if you're in a global company, is that you will interact with people you never would have interacted with before because they weren't in your office. So
Yes.
I agree. I think there's some middle way, right, between figuring out ways to be consciously together and ways to support people in having their work-life balance a little bit more prominent in their career as opposed to the alternatives I think we've both experienced. What have you learned about work-life balance in your career? What recommendations might you make to someone, also interested in what they do and wanting to do their best, but wanting to find a way to also have a home life that's healthy?
I think what I discovered in my life and was magnified during the pandemic was everybody's different. There are people that are integrators, who can flip back and forth between thinking about work, thinking about their family life and their personal lives. And there are people that are segmenters who can't do that, who have to either be focused on work or they're focused on something else, right? And I think a lot of team dynamics in the hybrid work setting mean that leaders are going to have to cope with and understand how people see their work and integrate or segment accordingly, right? I am very guilty of not having enough boundaries throughout my life. And so I can't say I was an integrator. I was more of a blur. It was just a whole blur of things that I had to be dealt with, which, if you're not careful, leads to a lot of distraction, a lot of multitasking, a lot of self-delusion about how effective you're being with all those multitasking forays during the day. Now I am very much in favor of myself and others having boundaries. In other words, be clear about what your boundaries are. If you cannot pick up messages or jump on a Zoom call after 8 o'clock at night, say so. All right, we'll figure out a way to work with that. So there's got to be something between sort of the everything goes to the my ways or the highway kind of thinking that a lot of bosses and leaders seem to have.
Yeah, I love that. I heard, I think it was Amy Porterfield, who's a big marketing online marketer. She said she has a list of core beliefs that she doesn't cross. So, like for her husband comes first, and she makes sure that if there's something with the husband, she makes sure that happens. I'm sure we have it with our kids. Like there's certain things I've tried to keep that list actually too, because I'm a blur-er too. And because I like it so much, I like what I'm doing, and my brain is kind of always thinking about things, and it can think about meditation and yoga classes that I want to run, and then it could think about something for my day job. So yeah, I think core beliefs help. Like every day we try to hit the sunset here in Duck, North Carolina when we're here, and that's at 5:30 right now, 5-ish 30, and we have to hit it. And when my husband comes down to say it's time, I could easily say no. There's always something I could do, but the sun won't wait for me, and he's important. It's been very helpful for me to have that core belief. Is that something that you can resonate with too?
I completely understand that. It's not like the remote works and you can pause the sunset. You can't pause
No.
certain things in life. And that's probably one way to look at it is to say the things that you can pause with a remote control, maybe you should. And the things that you can't, pay attention to. I think there's a John Lennon quote that says, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans, right? And I think that's one thing that we all learned to appreciate during the pandemic, that the simple things, here I am in my dining room looking outside for the past 4 years, I've really come to appreciate how beautiful my little house and my little yard are here, right? And if I had gone to work like I did before the pandemic for those 4 years, most of the time, particularly in the winter, I would never see the house during the day, except during the
That's right.
weekends. So I think it will ultimately make us more grateful for what we have if we pay attention to it. But I believe, like you do, that we've got to put some boundaries and priorities. We have to introduce our values to what we're doing.
Yeah, we don't want to look back and wonder what we did. You know, why did we do that and why did we not pay attention? Especially as our kids grow up, you realize how little time you really have with them and to make an impact in general. So I think it's humbling. As we tie up, what did I miss? What should I have asked?
Well, we could do two or three more shows, I think.
I think so. I would love that. I would love to have you back.
Well, thank
Just
you.
I'll just say it right now.
Thank you. There are plenty of topics, but hopefully the book will help people that are in facing transitions of their own. I tried to be vulnerable and honest about my own experiences and how difficult they were. One of the things I've learned from my friends and peers who are of similar age to me is they're all struggling to understand who they are without their title and their vocation. I think it's something as you get older that you really need to think about for your own well-being beyond work. So who am I when I'm not at work? Who am I when I'm not the boss? But I wish I'd learned that earlier. I think that that would have led me to better boundaries and better integration, more sunsets, more sunrises, all those things. And by the way, that's one of the things I think the next generation does better than we did. And I think it's resulted in a different set of values. And I never liked when my parents used to roll their eyes and say, kids today. And so I won't do that to my kids and the kids today, too. I think in many ways, it's time for them to take on the mantle of leadership earlier and sooner than we did in our careers. So I'm happy to come back and talk about any and all of that. But I am, as I say in the book, a tragic optimist about our future. I know that there are many problems and many problems that need to be solved. Some of them are monumental. Some of them are just every day. I know we can do it, but I know that also that it will take some tragedy and it'll take some missteps and some failures to get us there.
Yeah, I think that's how we learn.
Precisely. That's how we bounce back better.
That's how we bounce back better. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm just so honored to have spent this time. And yes, I want to have you back. I'll just already say it.
Well, thank you, Donna.
That's all for today. If you want to learn more about Stephen's book and current thinking on a wide array of topics, please visit his website. And those links will be in the show notes. I hope this episode was helpful for you. If it was, please subscribe, drop a review, or share it with your friends and family. That's the best way to get it in the hands of those who may benefit. And if my daughters, Sienna and Sylvia, are listening, I just want you to know how proud I am of you. And I love you so much. Bye now.